Before we begin, don't forget that if you want to hear this episode ad-free, then sign up to our members channel. Just search for What's the Story Crime in Apple Podcasts or follow the link in our show notes. Members will get exclusive access to all episodes of Smoking Gun, completely ad-free, before anyone else.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When it comes to the animal kingdom, there are few species which are disliked as universally as the maggot. While rats are considered to be vermin, you'll find plenty of owners who keep them as family pets. Snakes and spiders might cause some of you listening to break out in a cold sweat, but there will be others who find them the perfect creature to care for. Even the most lethal of animals, whether it's lions or hippos, have an army of fanatics who want to see them protected at all times. The same cannot be said for the maggot. That is, of course, unless you speak to an entomologist. Because, as this episode will show, maggots can play a crucial role in the world of law enforcement. And there are a number of specialists across the globe who have dedicated their careers to understanding how the maggot works and what evidence they can provide.
My name is Sarah Henderson. I've always been fascinated by the world of forensic science, the amazing ways in which crimes can be solved, and the clues which can be found almost anywhere.
And my name is Tracy Alexander from Forensic Response UK. I've spent years inside these processes, searching for those clues. I've dedicated my career to using science to help the course of justice. And my work has ensured that hundreds of criminals have gone to prison and the wrongly accused go free.
Together, we're going to lift the lid on some of the most extraordinary cases from around the world.
We'll discover how, with the help of science, everyday items have become the key to catching a killer.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is Smoking Gun, The Maggot. This episode tells the story of a case which saw a change in the laws, a prolonged fight for justice, and some extraordinary forensic science. And it begins in Ontario, Canada, with a 12-year-old girl called Lynn Harper. The year is 1959, and Lynn is just like every other soon-to-be teenager in this part of North America. She was a committed girl guide, a regular at Bible class and Sunday school. A child who was loyal to her family, trustworthy, kind-natured, the last person who deserved anything bad to happen. Lynn had actually been born Cheryl Lynn Harper in Ohio, USA. She had one older brother and one younger, and they were a typical family unit. Aged 10, they all moved to North Canada, following her father, who was posted with the US military. Their new home was the RCAF station Clinton, an airbase around 80 kilometres north of London, Ontario. The population was small, just 3,500 people in Clinton itself, and most of those with some sort of military connection. So it was a safe place where little went unnoticed. It was a fairly remote setting, sandwiched between Detroit to the west, Toronto to the east, and Cleveland to the south. And while the family were essentially in a different country, much of this part of Canada was just a stone's throw from the US, in the way it felt, as well as the distance. So Lynn didn't need to try hard to acclimatise. She missed her friends and her old routine, but there was nothing particularly foreign or unusual which she'd need to adjust to. And by 1959, she was settled, as all the family were. So when Lynn didn't come home on June 9th of that year, something immediately seemed to be wrong. Her absence was first reported to officials at the military base. Then to local law enforcement, and before long, there was a search party scouring the streets and looking for any clue as to where she might have gone. That search narrowed in on the last people to see Lynn.
Stephen Murray Truscott was 18 months older than Lynn, and he was also from a military family. He was the son of an Air Force officer, originally from Vancouver in the west of Canada, but now settled into life in Ontario. In fact, they'd arrived in Clinton just a year or so before the Harper family had, and so they shared the same common feeling of being new. As it was, despite their age gap, Stephen and Lynn were in the same class at the Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell School, located on the Air Force Base itself. They made friends and would be seen together on the way in or out of class. Indeed, on that June 9th afternoon, several witnesses saw Stephen and Lynn in the countryside around the school. They'd finished class, and Stephen had given her a lift, riding on the handlebars of his bike. The last sighting was around 7:30 p.m., with others seeing the pair a little earlier. But where had they been going? And what had happened that evening? Police officers needed to speak with Stephen and ask him some questions.
Perhaps it was the pressure of being quizzed, or perhaps he has something to hide, thought the officers. But Stephen's answers did not sound totally convincing. He'd admitted that he and Lynn had indeed been traversing the countryside on the many paths and lanes after school that day. But he insisted he'd left her at a junction and they'd gone their separate ways. He told those officers that she'd asked for a lift because she wanted to get to the main highway, and from there she planned to hitchhike to her grandmother's home a short drive away. Hitchhiking remains a common way of travelling across Canada, and it was certainly a viable story that Stephen was telling. But there were elements of it that the police doubted, and his being uncomfortable simply raised their suspicions. Lynn's family pointed to the fact that she was a cautious girl. Hitchhiking wasn't in her nature, at least as far as they were aware. There were other inconsistencies too, or clues which seemed to shine a light in Stephen's direction. Firstly, there was the fact that it had taken Stephen over 24 hours before he came up with the sighting, saying that after he'd left Lynn at the intersection, he'd ridden away and turned to see Lynn talking to another motorist who had stopped by the roadside before climbing into the vehicle. If he and Lynn were friends, why hadn't he volunteered this information as soon as he had learned that Lynn was missing? At a subsequent interview, Stephen offered more information, specifically that the vehicle she was climbing into was a late model Chevrolet, why hold such a key detail back? A physical examination of the 14-year-old also discovered some unusual marks on his genitalia, perhaps signs that he'd been involved in some recent sexual activity. But while Stephen was a person of interest, what the officers needed was to find Lynn alive. And sadly, that became an impossibility when 2 days after she was seen riding on the handlebars of Stephen's bicycle, her body was found on a tractor track on the edge of the town. She had been assaulted and strangled and left for dead.
Lynn's family were understandably distraught, and the news of the discovery rippled around the community like wildfire. All of a sudden, officers were hunting for a killer, and many in the area felt they knew exactly who it was. At 7 p.m. on June the 12th, Stephen Truscott was taken into custody. Detectives who examined the scene had made one further discovery. Bike tracks imprinted into the ground, close to where Lynn's body was found. It was the last nail in the case against Stephen. Everything pointed towards him being the person responsible. He was charged with Lynn's murder, and despite being just 14 years of age, he was ordered to stand trial in an adult court. Just 3 months later, he was asked to enter a plea in front of a jury. The court was led through the evidence, including the sightings of Stephen with Lynn riding on his handlebars away from Clinton, close to the track where her body was later found. They were told about Stephen's apparent sighting of a Chevrolet, which he claimed was picking her up on the highway, and his belief that she had been hitchhiking. They were shown images of the bike tire marks near where the body was found, and they were presented with some detailed forensic evidence in the form of a pathologist's report on the contents of Lynn's stomach. An expert had analysed Lynn's body and tested the partially digested food in her stomach. It wasn't an exact science, particularly in 1959, but the expert was able to put her time of death at between 7:15 and 7:30, almost exactly the time that it was agreed Stephen had been with Lynn on those country paths. This gave almost no window of time when Stephen wasn't with Lynn. And to the jury, the picture being painted was that Stephen hadn't just dropped Lynn at the intersection, but carried on to somewhere more secluded. He had sexually assaulted her, strangled her with her blouse, and then covered her body with branches. Faced with a whole host of circumstantial evidence and no other scenarios feeling likely, the jury decided to convict Stephen, despite his insistence that he was innocent. As Lynn's family wept, so did Stephen's. Two young lives were apparently now over as a result of this tragic case. On September the 30th, 1959, Stephen Truscott was sentenced to death. At 14 years of age, he faced being hanged for murder. And that decision prompted huge debates across the country. Many argued that a juvenile should be exempt from such a sentence. Others pushed back, saying that a life should mean a life. Capital punishment was legal in Canada in the 1950s, but campaigners pleaded for mercy. Did Canada really want the blood of a 14-year-old on their hands, regardless of the crime they'd committed? Stephen became a poster boy for the campaign, and it worked. It took just 4 months of protests and campaigning for the authorities to take notice. Stephen Truscott would be spared and serve a life sentence instead. It wouldn't be long before the death penalty was outlawed nationwide. The final execution in the country took place in 1961, thanks in no small part to the debate around Stephen's case.
Thank you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Serving time in prison as a 14-year-old will inevitably leave a scar. Stephen Truscott had maintained his innocence throughout his trial, and he continued to protest that he was a victim during his time behind bars. And unlike many convicts who argue for their innocence, Stephen found a wealth of supporters on the outside. They bought into his claims, his unwavering claim that he was not Lynn's killer, and the unusually quick investigation carried out by the police. They believed that Stephen had parted company with Lynn on that highway and left her to hitchhike, where, presumably, she was picked up by someone with bad intentions, driven off the road to the remote track, and killed. Firstly, an author called Isabelle Labordais took on Stephen's claims. She wrote a manuscript which put forward this alternative theory, attacked the police investigation, and argued that Stephen had been wrongly convicted. Her book caused a stir and brought the case back into the public eye. In fact, there was enough noise that the Canadian government ordered the Supreme Court of Canada to review the case. But they weren't moved by the claims in the media. They had statements, witness evidence, and the Canadian police who were adamant the right boy was behind bars, and they dismissed the calls for a retrial. The following year, the court convened again. This time, they were presented with 25 new witnesses who could speak to Stephen's innocence. And they heard further statements from Stephen, which hadn't been revealed in his first trial. The court considered this new evidence, knowing that the national media was watching. They ruled 8-1 in favour of upholding Stephen's conviction. The case had gone to the very top of the Canadian justice system, and they all agreed that justice had been served. That was that for Stephen Truscott. He remained in prison until 1969, serving his minimum 10-year tariff before he was eligible for parole. And having demonstrated that he wasn't a danger whilst behind bars, the parole board allowed Stephen to be released back into the community. Now aged 24, Stephen had a new chance at life.
Knowing that there would be public scrutiny around his release and a large number of people who believed him to be guilty, Stephen Truscott moved to the small community of Guelph in Ontario. Many there didn't know his real identity or his controversial past. He settled, got a job as a millwright, and assumed the name Stephen Bowers. Only if he was asked about the conviction would he bother to tell people he was innocent, because being able to prove it felt like an impossibility. He soon fell in love with a woman called Marlene, and the couple had three children. Stephen had grown from a boy to a man behind bars, but now, as he got older, he was, to outsiders, just a typical family man, getting old like the rest of us. It was when Stephen was in his 50s that a letter arrived at his door. It was from an investigative journalist from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation who wanted to interview Stephen about the case. Stephen thought long and hard about whether to bring it all back up again. His first instinct was to say no. He'd been through enough, and there was little to gain, he thought, by going back under the spotlight. But his wife, Marlene, thought otherwise. She believed her husband to be innocent and urged him to fight his corner. So he agreed to speak, to tell his story. And Canada listened. The following year, an appeal was made on his behalf to have the case reopened. In 2002, a judge was appointed to review the case. And in 2004, an official request was made to review any new evidence which might change the official verdict. Throughout this time, the family of Lynn Harper were kept informed. They'd lived for 40 years in the belief that Lynn's killer had been convicted. The case had constantly been brought back up in the media, and yet again, it looked like it wouldn't go away. This time, however, the investigation would be more invasive. Officers asked if they could exhume Lynn's body to reassess the clues it contained. Retrieving a body more than 40 years after it was committed to the ground is a task rarely carried out. But with great care, a team carried out the delicate task of recovering Lynn's remains. There was hope that there may be some DNA which could identify Stephen or someone else remaining on the body. But sadly, once the work was complete, there was nothing which could be recovered. But there was some evidence which could be looked at with fresh eyes. Maggots, which had been present on Lynn's body when it was discovered on that track, had been collected and retained by the original investigating officers. Those maggots could be assessed, and with modern techniques deployed by an entomologist, could provide some reasonable doubt that Lynn had been killed before 8 p.m. If Lynn's death hadn't occurred until after 8 p.m., then Stephen Truscott couldn't have been her killer. In fact, the maggots could even indicate that Lynn had died the following day, raising even more doubt about Stephen's conviction. This new discovery forced investigators to review the case through a new lens. All along, they'd been led by the understanding that the time of death placed Stephen at the scene, which in turn made him likely to be guilty. But if that time of death was wrong, well, that changed everything. The modern investigators went back through the files. They reread the paperwork, and they found something surprising. The time of death had been estimated by a pathologist who had analysed Lynn's stomach contents. He'd given evidence in court that she had died between 7:15 and 7:30. And this evidence was crucial in placing Stephen with her at the time of her death. But in his first report, he'd indicated a different time of death. In his second report, there was another different time. And only after detectives had pinpointed Stephen's own timings that evening did the pathologist present a third statement, which gave the time of death as between 7:15 and 7:30. What had prompted the three different estimates, they wondered? And why hadn't the court or Stephen's defence team seen them before? Compounding that discovery was a letter sent by the pathologist to the lead investigator in 1966. In it, he admitted making an agonising reappraisal of the evidence and said that he should never have offered up such a narrow window for the time of death. This letter had also never been shared with the defence.
There were two more details that officers found during their reinvestigation into the case. An elderly couple who had come forward at the time to tell police that they'd seen a young woman hitchhiking on the highway close to where Lynn had been seen with Stephen. If they were correct, then perhaps Stephen had been telling the truth. They believed that what they'd seen could be relevant, but it was evidence which wasn't heard in the original trial. There was also the discovery in an undisclosed police report that the bike tracks found near to Lynn's body could have been there for up to a week before the murder. There was significant doubt that they belonged to the killer. All of this new evidence was considered and weighted. The time of death, the new witness, the bike tracks. All of a sudden, investigators thought the case looked very different. It was on August 28, 2007, that the Court of Appeal acquitted Stephen Truscott of the murder of Lynn Harper. They said that they couldn't be confident that Truscott was innocent, but that he could not have been convicted beyond reasonable doubt. 48 years after the murder of Lynn Harper, Stephen Truscott was finally able to tell people he wasn't guilty. The Attorney General of Ontario apologised on behalf of the Canadian government, saying he was truly sorry for the miscarriage of justice. "I'm not bitter," Truscott told journalists. "You can't live day after day being bitter. I've moved on with my life. My wife and I raised a family. I was always taught to look at things positively." Stephen was awarded $6.5 million Canadian dollars by way of compensation. Part of that he used to set up the Truscott Initiative in Justice Studies at his local university in Guelph, Ontario. But not everyone welcomed the news. Lynn's family remained steadfast in their belief that Stephen had been responsible. They were angered by the decision to grant Stephen an apology, and they revealed that they wouldn't tell Lynn's father the news because of how it would upset him. The case is regarded as one of the most contentious in Canadian legal history. It helped to change a law on capital punishment. It showcased the role of journalists in challenging the evidence in a criminal case. And it proved that persistence and determination can win through. But none of that could have been possible without the maggots, which first raised doubts about the time of death. Preserved for 40 years, they carried with them the evidence which brought the whole case into question and offered an entirely new version of events. Smoking Gun is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's narrated by me, Sarah Henderson.
And by me, Tracy Alexander. The series is supported by Forensic Response UK. Our work promotes the international fight to improve forensic techniques, to share ideas, and develop the crime-solving scientific advances of the future.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and review and help to spread the word. You can listen to a new episode of Smoking Gun every week wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to listen to all episodes right now, you can find them completely ad-free on our subscription channel, What's the Story Crime. On there, you'll also get exclusive access to a whole bunch of bonus interviews led by me, where I speak to some of the most experienced and skilled forensic scientists from around the world and find out more about what they do. Those interviews are only available on What's the Story Crime.
There's also a whole range of brilliant true crime content all made by the same team. You can check out The Missing, with more than 60 episodes all about long-term missing people, which invites you to try and help solve the case. You'll also find exclusive series like Jigsaw, true crime investigations like 900 Degrees, and incredible stories told over several parts. Whatever you're into, if you enjoy listening to Smoking Gun, we're sure you'll find your next must-listen podcast on What's the Story Crime. Signing up is really easy. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, just search for What's the Story Crime, subscribe, and you'll get all your favourite shows ad-free. For listeners on Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or any other platform, all you need to do is click the link in our show notes or visit www.whatsthestorysounds.com/crime. Your subscription helps to ensure we can keep making more of the content you love. And it costs just $3.99 per month.